It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Hopeful Environmentalists, a podcast where we discuss hope in the climate space with amazing guest speakers. In this episode, I speak with the founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, Asrei Oriel Lake, to discuss the importance of women's leadership when it comes to climate solutions and equitability. We also look at some questions that she poses throughout her book, such as, can we undo the doing? We look at rights of nature and how we can change our worldviews as climate solutions, and so much more. But before we get into the episode and I introduce our guest speaker, I have an exciting conference opportunity that I'd love to share with you all. This April, the EarthX 2024 Congress of Conferences is the sustainability summit you won't want to miss. 5 days of conferences covering the built environment, the natural environment, e-capital, oceans, island resilience, and conservation. The range of people, power, perspectives, and potential will be unmatched, and this conference will be one you won't want to miss. The EarthX conference will attract the world's foremost environmentalists, conservationists, scientists, academics, entrepreneurs, business leaders, family offices, and policymakers engaged in the environmental space today. EarthX brings together people from all sides to engage in powerful conversations for one important mission: protecting our planet. Please join us at EarthX Congress of Conferences, April 22nd through April 26th in Dallas, Texas. Go to earthx.org to register now and get more details. Now I'd love to introduce our guest speaker, the founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, also known as WECAN. Asrei Oriel Lake works internationally with grassroots, BIPOC, and Indigenous leaders, policymakers, and diverse coalitions to build climate justice, resilient communities, and a just transition to a decentralized, democratized, clean energy future. She sits on the Executive Committee for the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature and on the Steering Committee for the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. Asrei's writing about climate justice, relationships with nature, women in leadership, and other topics has been featured in The Guardian, Earth Island Journal, The Ecologist, Miss Magazine, and many other publications. She is the author of the award-winning book, Uprising for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with Nature. She also recently published a book, The Story is in Our Bones, How Worldviews and Climate Justice Can Remake a World in Crisis. Asrei holds an MA in Culture and Environmental Studies from Holy Names University in Oakland and lives in the San Francisco Bay Area on Coast Miwok lands. So without further ado, I'd love to introduce our guest speaker, Asrei.
Hi, welcome onto the podcast. So happy to have you on today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so let's get right into talking about the organization that you founded, WECAN. What was the inspiration of starting it, and what are the current things WECAN is working on?
So WECAN stands for the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, but I love our acronym WECAN, so I'm glad that you said that, because that's also a mouthful to say. And I'm really dedicated to how we are going to address this climate crisis that is barreling down on us. And, you know, very specifically, how do we actually address root causes and get into talking about solutions from a viewpoint and perspective of justice and equity? Like, that's really the heart of the organization. And, you know, just a little bit about the founding, I have been an artist for many years, actually, and at the same time, very involved in environmental issues all my life. I grew up in the town of Mendocino, which is about 4 hours north of San Francisco on the coast of California. And there, the big struggles when I was growing up were around the redwood forests. And I just absolutely adore the Redwood Forest. They're my family, my mentors, my beloved tree friends. And, I watched a lot of clear-cut logging in my youth. And that really was my first understanding that something was terribly wrong in the world, that we were destroying these ancient forests. And at this point, there's only about 4% of them left on this corridor here. And that was very devastating to me. So anyways, that was sort of like where I first cut my teeth on a campaign was the protection of the Redwood Forests. And then fast forward, actually walking in the forests in, it was around 2009 when the Obama administration came into office. And there was a lot of hope for many of us that when he went to the United Nations climate talks that happen every year, that there would be some kind of transformation. There would be a transformative policy with world governments. And that did not happen, to make a long story short. And I was walking in the Redwoods and listening and walking. And instead of feeling calm and nurtured in my forest walk, I was feeling like I was just hearing this screaming and crying out from the earth. And, I mean, it sounds a little dramatic, but it's what happened. And I, in the course of a very short period of time, stopped everything I was doing and said, I've got to work on this issue. What about future generations? What about the way that, frontline communities, indigenous Black and Brown communities are being impacted first and worst by climate change? And I couldn't continue on. And I started doing a lot of research, and now it's more of a narrative that people are engaged in. But at the time, there wasn't a lot of visibility around the connection at the nexus of women and gender and the climate crisis, both in terms of how, due to gender inequality, women are impacted more than men around the climate crisis and climate impacts. But also, one of the untold stories was that women are leaders of climate solutions and are not being visibilized and lifted up in the way that they should be. And women are essential to this transition we're in to change our trajectory. And I'll just give one stat just so that it's not sort of floating out there. But I found this really powerful study that I've utilized in different meetings with the Scenarios Forum, which is a forum that feeds information to the IPCC scientists. And the study shows that just with a 1 unit increase in the Women's Political Empowerment Index, which is an index that shows, women's social status in any particular country, how they're doing in the economy, how they're engaged in politics. It's called the Women's Political Empowerment Index. And with just a 1 unit increase, you get an 11.51% drop in carbon emissions, which is hard to find anything that would create something over 10%. Now, it's not all about carbon emission reductions by a long shot when we're talking about the climate crisis and intersectional movement building and poly crisis we're facing, but still, just as like one indicator of the role of women's leadership and why it's so important. And I could go on. There's, pages on our website people are welcome to look at around why we can demonstrate fact after fact, why women are key to this moment in time and movement building around the climate crisis and the solutions we're offering. So that's when I started the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network to say, wow, here's a node of transformation. We need to uplift this. We need to empower women. And so I've been doing that ever since.
That's incredible. And the 1% increase and the 11% in reduction in carbon emissions, that is crazy. I haven't seen that. So I definitely am going to have to read that. That sounds so incredible. So thank you for bringing that up. That's awesome. But I also want to get into something that you talked about a little bit about solutions with justice and equity. Because I see a lot of the times we're talking about, okay, let's just do a bunch of solar and a bunch of renewables, which are great, but where are we looking at how it's impacting communities, specifically, like you mentioned before, Black and Brown communities and Indigenous communities? So I've heard a concept and I've talked about it with some people as well called a just transition. And I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit, because I think that's a really important thing to discuss.
Absolutely. So, in my book, The Stories in Our Bones, How Worldviews and Climate Justice Can Remake a World in Crisis, I'm going deeply into this topic. So, I'm really glad that you brought it up to really look at exactly as you said, even if we put up lots of solar panels and wind turbines and invest in, you know, renewable energy, which I think is really critical. I mean, my day-to-day work at Weekend, you know, these are things that we're very engaged in, you know, promoting renewable energy, but also ensuring that it's done with respects to indigenous rights and human rights, you know, in terms of how we actually extract the minerals out of the ground. I mean, there's a lot of complications. It's not just like we get to get off of fossil fuels and go into renewable energy without examining the systems that we're in, the extractive economy that we're in. So yeah, we are engaged every day in projects around reforestation and forest protection and stopping fossil fuel pipelines and going to the United Nations climate talks, as I mentioned. So all of those things are very key. And yet, if we were to wave a magical wand, let's say, and end the climate crisis tomorrow, it wouldn't end environmental degradation. It wouldn't address social inequality. People would still be consuming. We would not be decolonizing our minds and hearts. Things would not change in the way that they actually need to address the level of crises humanity is now facing. And so this is why we need things like the just transition and a deeper analysis, and why in my book, I'm going upstream to really look at the worldviews and the systems of oppression that we're in, because we need a systemic approach and a way to look at root causes of these problems. Because like I said, if we were just instantly to, you know, be gone with the climate crisis, we would continue to be going off of a cliff and frontline communities would continue to be harmed. So what I'm looking at, so it's not, you know, so we can get very specific, we're looking at the systems of oppression of patriarchy, racism, colonization, and capitalism. And I would also add in imperialism and, you know, militarism as we look at the war in Gaza and other areas of conflict that are very unjust. And when we unpack these things, we have to really look at like what caused these horrific systems of oppression as a social construct, and how do we begin to understand them, unpack them, and then dismantle them and transform them. And I think this is the process we're in right now. And sort of how I view it is like, well, one world is burning, which it is as the climate crisis escalates. Another world is being birthed. Another world is being called forward by our collective movements and our collective psyche at a very deep level. We know we can be living in a much more beautiful and harmonious way with the earth and each other. And this is part of the foundation of the just transition. How do we transition first and foremost off of fossil fuels, which are killing all of us, into renewable energy? But how do we do it? How do workers get cared for in this transition? We don't want to leave all the fossil fuel workers, you know, without jobs. How do we do it in a way that they're part of the new energy transition? How do we ensure, as I was mentioning earlier, that as we move off of fossil fuels and renewable energy, that we don't just, you know, take the same system that got us into these crises.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
In the first place, and now put them on the renewable energy transition. We can't do that. We cannot keep extracting from the land. We cannot keep ignoring indigenous rights. We cannot keep plundering Black and brown and indigenous communities where most of this extraction takes place and the harms occur, you know, from pollution in their waters and air to just the destruction of their ecosystems. And so the just transition is all about, we know we need to make this transition, but how do we do it? And how do we ensure that it is done in a way that is healthy and equitable for everyone and our Mother Earth?
I love that. Yeah, I love that so much. And thank you for really going into that topic, because I think it's something that people, especially outside the movement, who are like, oh, well, look, like my mom to me the other day was like, oh, they're putting solar panels here and here and this. And I'm like, that's great, right? We do need renewables, but how are we doing it? Are we making sure that workers are being paid fairly and being treated fairly? So I really appreciate you bringing that up and going into depth with that. And something that I saw in your book that you posed a few times, a question that you posed a few times was, can we undo the doing? And I love that. That was one of the parts I had to put the book down and just like think about it, like really just like think about it for myself, like personally for myself. And without spoiling your book and what you talk about, because we want everyone to go read it, can you discuss this a little bit and what that means and what that means to you?
Well, I love that you connected in with that phrase. And yeah, I, as you know, the book is very technical in certain parts, but it's also very lyrical and poetic, because I'm really working to engage all of us emotionally, mentally, physically, and spiritually. So we show up for this moment really present as full human beings, because, you know, we're at a critical juncture in the human adventure here on Earth. And it's not going so well for many people. And so while, you know, I remain very hopeful and celebratory and we want to enjoy our lives, I think it's also really important to understand this juncture we're in and how perilous it is, really, and the choices that we have. And so I'm asking this question sort of in a philosophical and poetic way to help inspire other ways of knowing and other ways of thinking of things. So I particularly like that it actually caused you to pause. I like that very much, because we can't just continue with sort of a superficial treatment of our own thinking or soundbite realities. It's just not going to be enough. And I want things to be very inviting for people to take a deeper dive and to think about things like, wow, you know, we're so engaged with doing, making, busy, you know, more and more development, more and more material development. And it comes from this whole stream and ideology around a worldview that is based on capitalism and colonization and extractive economies, which is like a machine that just drives where there's more and more and more and more taking from the land, more taking from each other. And this idea that we have to just keep consuming, and that productivity is the foundation of what we're doing here on Earth, is to produce and to do. And now we have overdone, if you will. Now we've done to the point of overdone, overconsumption, over extraction, that have led to so much peril. And so the question really provokes an inquiry into, how do we undo the doing? What does it mean to slow down? What does it mean to remove ourselves from the extractive economy? What does it mean to grow our own food? What does it mean to find other ways of valuing our lives other than endless economic material growth? How do we build relationships? How do we share poetry? How do we share creativity? There's so many ways that we can learn and grow as human beings that is not based on, you know, sort of this progressive idea of development. And so, you know, there's many inquiries that can come out of that question, but that's what comes to mind in the moment.
Yeah, I think it'll be a very important thing for other people who read it to think about this as well, because, you know, we see these like things pop up, like burnout, like that word, that I love that word, and I feel burnt out a lot, and I think a lot of us do now because of our jobs, social media, everything that's going on in the world. Being able to engage with this, and like you said, engage emotionally with something and just think about what future we want to create and that we can create it. So I really appreciate your words. But I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned as well before, you know, the statistic about we increase women leadership 1% and we can see this carbon reduction in emissions and things like that. So how does empowering women from across the world positively impact climate outcomes?
So that's one example that we talked about, but there are so many. So I love our organization because there's so many remarkable women leaders that we work with. And I would also say people across the gender spectrum. It's important that we don't, for me, get into binaries. You know, it's about opening up the dialogue of leadership that isn't, to put it bluntly, only white men. And it's not about putting men down, but about women being lifted up. That's, you know, how I like to view it, because everyone has value. But right now we need balance, and we're out of balance. And so we need to put back into the knowledge streams and places of power women's leadership. It's essential. And so, again, I could share a lot of stats around this, you know, just to give a few more, like 40 to 80% of all household food production in the global South is done by women, which is key to mitigating the climate crisis, how we're producing our food. When we look at a lot of drought-stricken areas, United Nations studies show that when women are in charge of a lot of these water programs and drought areas, the programs work. And if you remove them, the programs don't work, because the women are collecting the water. They're caring for their families. They're watching the water tables. That's their realm. Women are water keepers and water caretakers and water stewards. So you can't X them out of the equation or things don't function properly. I think another really good example is, as we're still on the edge of coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, at the height of the pandemic, we could see many stories that came out in the news and then research that was done that showed that countries that were led by women did far better in navigating their populations through the COVID-19 pandemic than men. And so I think that we just need to look at, both the statistics, but also just our lived experience about the role of women's leadership. So many of the movements we're in around climate or social justice or racial justice, you're going to see women at the helm, even if they're not being named or visibilized. I can guarantee you a lot of the leadership is being done by women. The organizing and backbone of these movements is often women. And we need to recognize that. We need to elevate that. It's a key component in changing the trajectory we're on. And so, yes, I think both in terms of the grassroots up to the top levels of business and financial institutions, we need to be engaging women at every level in every sector and bring them into the conversation and ensure they're at decision-making tables.
And, when we look at spaces like international climate conferences and talking about how women are being left out, we see very male-dominated spaces. I saw a report that said something like 15 out of 133 of the world leaders participating in COP28 were women. So only 15. Like it's such a small amount. It's like, okay, great that we had 15 women there. We're not dismissing those 15 women and their experiences, but only 15, we need to see more. Obviously, that's not even close to half. So how can we uplift women leadership to ensure our crucial voices are not just heard, but also represented and incorporated in these decisions being made for all of our futures?
Mm. Very good point. And I was actually at COP28 and we were discussing so much of this and the fact of, the lack of representation of women leaders. And, we're part of something called the Women and Gender Constituency, which is an amazing constituency as part of the UN Climate Talk process, the UNFCCC process, very powerful women leaders from all over the world who are constantly advocating for gender responsive climate policies and getting more and more women and gender diverse leaders into these spaces. And it's critical for all the reasons we just talked about the role of women. So you're absolutely right to point out the need for us to figure out how do we keep increasing the role of women's leadership and ensuring that women are in the spaces they need to be in. And just to note that actually at the beginning of the year, we learned at COP29 coming up at the end of this year, the COP presidency every year, wherever the climate talks are, they move around to different countries. There's the presidency is based upon the country where that COP is taking place. And at the end of the year, it will be happening in Azerbaijan. And so they chose their president, who unfortunately also is related to fossil fuels, like the one that was the same happened with the COP presidency in Dubai last year. But in any case, once they announced their presidency, they show their team. There was not one woman on the team, not one. And so you're asking about what can we do? So our organization and others all wrote letters, did press releases saying this is completely unacceptable to have no women on the COP presidency team. And they did change it and they brought women on. So there's an example of advocacy and collective work to make demands on governments that they have to change what they're doing. And there's so many examples, but that's one that just came to mind that happened fairly recently at the international stage on the climate discussion. And I think, so that's sort of at a global level, but, on a very personal level, let's just bring it really close to home. If you or any of your listeners are working in coalitions or working in an organization or in a group on these critical issues, let's all be really careful and lifting up the women, our sisters who are engaged in these movements. If we're in a meeting and a woman is speaking out, really stand with her. We hear these typical stories, but believe me, I experience it on a daily basis. You're in a room, you're in a meeting, even with, allies who are in the climate justice movement, and a woman will say something and everyone will, nod and maybe hear it. And then the talk goes to a man in the room and he might say the exact same thing And then the idea is solidified and acknowledged. And I mean, I know that we hear these stories all the time, but it's not over. So it's kind of like at a you know, micro scale and a macro scale at the same time. Like, what can we do most immediately to uplift women's voices and push for gender equity in our personal lives and just our experiences, making sure women are heard and that we stand with women and we lift them up. And then understanding that ripples out to every level of society, where we need to stand with women and ensure that they're funded, that their voices are heard, that we vote them into office. Every sphere that we operate in, it's one of the most important solutions to what many academics are calling a polycrisis, because there's the climate crisis, there's the economic crisis, there's racial injustice.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
There's gender injustice. You know, we could go on. And so, you know, one of the key factors time and time again is women's leadership around peacekeeping, around changing our economy. So, yeah, I don't think we could stress enough the need to generate egalitarian societies. And one of the ways to do that is to get women into positions of leadership.
Yeah, and I love how you discuss, it's also about empowering each other. I think sometimes there's a lot of, I don't want to say competition, but within this capitalistic society, people want to move up and people want to move up in the world in certain places. And it's like, just sometimes supporting other women is the best way to do it. It's not always about ourselves and gaining something. It's about when one woman is succeeding, we are all succeeding. And I really love that you brought that up, and how just support other women, just go out there and support someone in your organization who is speaking or who is bringing up ideas, and support them and support their ideas. So I love that. And thank you for bringing that up. And going back to your book a little bit. So in your book, you weave in stories of resistance, peace, hope, solutions, and coming from women from around the world. And you discuss different ways of thinking and how shifting mindsets and worldviews, especially from those within, as you discuss, the dominant culture or the Western culture, which you define, can really begin to make a difference for our planet and its inhabitants. So how does openness to worldviews and different worldviews, especially those from women and communities impacted by this dominant culture, begin to create the urgency that we need to create a future that is void of ecological and cultural breakdown?
I love that you asked that really deep question. It's very thoughtful. And yeah, I think that when we look at worldviews, it allows us to think differently than we are right now, because the worldview we're in right now is how we got into this crisis. As we mentioned, these different systems of oppression on capitalism and patriarchy, all of these things. And so if we're going to really change how we're relating to nature and one another, then it really begs the question of, what is our idea of equity? What is our idea of living in right relationship with nature? What is our idea about how the world came into being? What is our idea about a living earth? And this is really at the core, which is, I think, part of the transformation we're in right now, is being open to the idea outside of a Western context. And again, to be very specific, one of the things that I'm really unpacking in my book is what got us into this idea of white supremacy and how do we unpack that and transform it and compost it? And where did the patriarchy come from? The origins of that? How do we unpack that? How do we compost and transform that? And including colonization and capitalism as well. And I think we can look towards some very specific patterns, like how a lot of world religions, and again, I'm not like a religious scholar or saying religions are bad. I'm just interrogating some of the thinking behind them. As an example, in our dominant culture, there are a lot of tenets that say humans are more important than nature. Humans should have dominion over the earth. Well, that's not working out for us very well. We need to be living in a reciprocal, relational way with the earth, to live in harmony with nature and to have economies and governance structures and ways of living that are within the planetary boundaries, not above them. And so this is part of being open to a different worldview, that we're not here to have dominion over nature. We're here to be life enhancing and be part and particle of the web of life, or that men are more important than women, or white people are more important than Indigenous and Black and Brown people. All of these things, or we're separate from nature, instead of knowing that we're part of this magnificent earth lineage. And so when we start looking at worldviews, we can actually have a discussion about what is the water that we're swimming in, and getting aware of the water that we're swimming in. And is it healthy water? Is it where we want to be swimming? And to begin to open up these questions can then open us up to root causes of our problems so that we can transform them. Because it's sort of like if you go to the doctor and you're ill, the first thing they're going to want to do is a diagnosis. They can't just start treating you. I mean, there's lots of good vitamins to take and lots of stuff to take, but which ones you need have to be ascertained, which requires diagnosis. So that's kind of the roadmap that I'm creating in my book, The Stories in Our Bones, is to look at, you know, what are the worldviews that are detrimental in our dominant culture, and how can we look at ones that are healthy and begin to transform our systems of thinking into a way that will be equitable and healthy for nature and people and planet being positioned first, not the demands of corporations and the wealthy elite. And how do we turn this around? So I think this is really getting at sort of the core of what we need to be doing in our movements.
Yeah, and I think something important that you mentioned as well, and that can be tied into this, is it's okay to change our minds on things, right? A lot of us within the Western view and the Western culture have grown up to believe these things are okay and certain things are okay when it's not. And it's okay to change our views. It's okay to listen to these worldviews different than your own and say, okay, what I learned needs to go away. We need to throw that out. Take it out of the brain, unlearn it. And I've seen that a lot. And I've seen from someone I listen to on, has a podcast and a big social media presence, is Michaela Loach. And she talks about unlearning. So I really love that. And for people who are listening, definitely go check out her work. She's awesome. So yeah, is there anything you wanted to else mention on worldviews? I think it's such a big topic and something that can be talked about forever, especially like you talked about it so much in your book. And I loved that so much because I learned a lot of different things from a lot of the different perspectives that you brought up. So is there any like perspective in the book? I know all of them are very powerful, but is there anyone that right now, that if you wanted to give people like a little bit of a taste of the book, what perspective really hit home for you?
Well, one of the things that I think is very important in our time is really changing from this idea that the earth is dead matter to the fact that we're living in a living ecology, that we're part of an animate cosmology. And how do we move Western science and Western worldviews into understanding that the forest is alive, the trees are alive, the river is alive, the waters, the oceans, the mountains, the air, all the plants and animals are alive. The earth, whether you want to call it Gaia or Mother Earth, is a living being. And this completely transforms how we relate to the earth when we understand that the earth is our relative, that the river is our relative, that the forests are our relatives, the stones are our relatives, and we're not here on this, you know, dead matter earth, and everything is just a resource for us to use in any which way we want. I think it's a very dangerous worldview from the Western perspective or modern perspective, whatever you want to call it, that has to be composted and transformed. And also, life is just so more joyous and fun when we realize that the earth is alive and there's so much mystery and magic and wonder to behold when we start living as part and particle of nature and understanding our place in the earth lineage. So one of the concepts, as you know, that I'm working with a lot in the book is, you know, how do we enliven and reclaim this earth lineage and this understanding of a living cosmology and an animate earth that is in our bones, hence the title of the book, The Stories in Our Bones. It still resides in us, even if we live in a society or brought up to think that we're separate from nature or above nature. It doesn't change the fact that in our bodies, in our ancestral knowledge, that we know that, you know, we're just one of the critters here on this planet. And so I think it's something that we can keep coming at from different angles is, you know, how do we change our language to be earth enhancing and earth loving? How do we practice being in a living earth? How do we talk about our earth in a different way? And even the term like resource means that we're reducing, you know, the Mississippi River or the Amazon River to a reduction of a resource. Or if we look at the boreal forest or the redwood forest and we reduce them to just saying board feet, these resources, it immediately has like this mercantile impact on talking about the forest or the waterway versus these living beings, these living ecosystems that are our relatives, that are alive, that we're responsible for caretaking and stewarding. If it's just resources, which creates the commodification and financialization of nature, which is very reductive and allows us to harm those ecosystems because we're completely removed from them. So I think part of our worldview change is seeing ourselves in this living earth and celebrating that and awakening that within ourselves and in our communities. And I think that perspective would change things very radically.
Yeah, I've heard that perspective a lot recently, you know, talking about how the forest is a resource, but it has value on its own. A tree being in the ground has value of giving us oxygen and of doing way more than just giving us oxygen. It gives habitat to many different animals and plants and all these things. So I love that perspective as well. And it's very realistic and very true and very real. And another thing that you discussed a little bit is about that the earth is our relative. And I saw an amazing quote from Shiapasita, who is an indigenous climate activist, and she was presenting at a conference talking about how when we burn fossil fuels, we're burning our ancestors. And that hit me so hard. I was like, wow, I never thought about it like that. And I never really dove into that topic. So thinking about that, really, again, another worldview that changes our perspective. And that's why it's so important to look at different worldviews and really, really try to understand them and try to change our own perspectives to be more open to them. So I really love that. And I love that you brought that up. So thank you for bringing that up. You're bringing up such amazing things, every single one.
You're asking great questions.
So another thing is for women who are listening to the episode right now and want to get started in their journey of advocacy and resistance of extractivist and capitalistic societies and forces and are overwhelmed of where to start, because that I know I feel that a lot. What advice would you give on getting started? And I know that it's not, there's not just one path, but if there is something that you could give on your perspective within your own journey or other journeys that you've heard or seen, what advice would you give?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. And it is overwhelming. I mean, I think it's good to name that this is an overwhelming time between wars going on, what is happening in Gaza, what is happening with our environment, with people facing droughts and floods everywhere, all over the earth now, thinking about future, especially for young women. It's daunting. And I have a lot of those conversations. I appreciate you naming the overwhelm, because in our politics in the United States, oh my goodness, just all of it is a lot to take in. And a few things I would offer. And as you said, there's many offerings, many different ways to approach how we want to engage. One is we cannot do this alone. One of the most important things is we need community, even if it's one other friend, but it's too much to carry on our own. It's too much to think about. It's too much to unpack. It's too much to grieve. It's too much to imagine about alone. So I think the first thing is, even if it's just one person to really connect with, and then hopefully a community of people to connect with. And I think that's one of the most important places to begin is, you know, connecting to groups who are working on issues that you care about. I do think it is a path forward. And I try to encourage people to go inside of themselves and find out what's really lighting them up, because our hearts are going to lead us in the right direction. It's like the poet Rumi said, you know, listen to your heart and run there. And I love that saying, because that's what will sustain us. We have endless energy for the things that we love. And so even if it's something you don't know, but you're passionate about, that's going to carry you a long way. So it's sort of like a marriage of finding out what we're passionate about, finding out what we love in these very broad movement spaces. There's so much to be done on anti-racism and colonization and climate justice. I mean, there's so many entry points, food sovereignty, the land back movement. You know, whatever lights you up, start there and then find your community, find the people that you can be with in community and can help carry you. And I think that's the best road to go in and focus on that and realize you can't do it all. It's an ecosystem. It's an ecosystem. So when I see a lot of the women in my network who are working on issues that I'm not, it excites me. I'm like, okay, good. They have that part of the ecosystem that they're handling. And I'm over here doing my corner of the world. And then together, you know, we can be perhaps enough to get through the crisis together as best as we can. And so, yeah, we don't have to do it all, but find the thing that excites you the most and find your people and go from there.
Yeah, no, that's so important. Because I know for me, and I think a lot of people within my generation, we're constantly thinking we have to do everything, whether that be within advocacy spaces or just in like in our daily lives. We think we have to do everything all the time because a lot of it has to do with social media, I think, but there's a lot of pressure. And knowing that you don't have to do everything and that it's okay to not need to do everything, I think that's something that will be really important for our generation and to be able to understand and to be able to, I just want to nail that in everyone's head. It's like, you don't need to do everything. And I need to nail it in my head because I'm constantly like, I need to do everything. I hope people listening, everyone, every generation listening knows that the weight is not all on your shoulder. And there's so many people, amazing people doing such incredible work out there. Like I'm learning new things about so many different activists and people every single day. So yeah, it's very important to know that. So last question I love to ask all of my guests is, what gives you hope for our collective future?
Young people like you bring me lots of hope. All your energy, your thinking, your strategy. I know it's kind of corny, but young people do bring me a lot of hope. And the intelligence, the brilliance, the focus from young people is very, very hopeful to me. And then I'm going to name a few things in case your listeners are interested in a couple of things that I find really exciting. One is the Rights of Nature movement, which I devote a couple of chapters to in my book, which, you know, kind of going back to our earlier part of our conversation about seeing this animate living earth, where there's actually a legal system and a form of earth jurisprudence or earth philosophy that brings into our current legal context this idea that the earth should have rights, like humans have rights, the earth should have rights. And I really love that as a paradigm shift, because we can then talk about ecosystems having the right to thrive and grow and be healthy, separate from human activities, that they have that right independently, inherently on their own. And it's not just an idea, but an idea that is in practice right now. In Ecuador, in 2008, it was the first country to put rights of nature to their constitution. So it's been at the constitutional level in Ecuador, and there are rivers in Ecuador that have been protected under rights of nature legislation. And it's a fast-growing movement. The United Nations Secretary General at the end of last year said the fastest-growing environmental movement right now is earth jurisprudence, which rights of nature is a part of. And so it's a way of viewing nature that also changes our paradigm and worldview around nature to see, oh, we're not above nature. We are part of the web of life. And there's been about 36 cases in the United States at the local level of changing ordinances to protect nature and protect waterways from fracking and from fossil fuel extraction. In Colombia, there were rights of nature laws passed to protect the Amazon rainforest. One place that really is dear to my heart is in New Zealand, where the Whanganui River has been given personhood, has been recognized as having personhood. I should say recognize, because we don't give, we recognize and acknowledge these rights. And it's just a beautiful thing, because the Maori people for over 100 years fought and struggled and advocated to protect the Whanganui River. And not very long ago, they were able to create a settlement with the New Zealand government that the Whanganui River has personhood and has rights like a human, that you can't harm the river to thrive and be healthy and not violated. And now there is someone from the Whanganui tribe and a leader from the government who co-steward the river and protect the river under these new laws. And I was very fortunate to be able to go there some years ago to meet some of the Maori elders who were engaged from the Whanganui tribe in this work around rights of nature and personhood and go to the Whanganui River. And I was there with a beautiful elder as she sang a song to the river when we were there. And when she was done, she took my hand and she said, "We have a saying here. I am the river and the river is me. I am the river and the river is me." And it so deeply touched me because all at once I could recall, as we've all learned in science, you know, that, you know, most of our bodies are consisting of water. And then just feeling the river in front of me and seeing the full spectrum of the water cycles all over the earth, and that, you know, we can't live without water. And this understanding that the water is our living relative and how that changes how we would treat the river is profound. And so I love this rights of nature work because it helps us reframe our relationship to nature, but also gives us legal standing to protect nature. So I wanted to bring up, you know, this rights of nature work, which I find quite hopeful. And then I'll just mention two other things quickly. One is I firmly believe in and advocate, and it's a big part of our work at WeCan, is in Indigenous rights. Indigenous peoples and their traditional ecological knowledge are a climate solution. And we need to lift up Indigenous rights. 80% of all the biodiversity left on Earth is in the lands and hands of Indigenous peoples that they're stewarding. And there's a reason for that, which is, again, this worldview that we've been talking about caring for this living earth. So I think we have so much to learn from Indigenous people in a respectful way, not in an extractive way, but to be respectful and learn about the Indigenous peoples wherever we live and lift up their calls to action, lift up their sovereignty, lift up their rights, lift up land back movements. So I think there's so much we need to do to center Indigenous leadership right now. And then lastly, I wanted to mention something called the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, which I'm on the steering committee of. And this is a very powerful movement that was founded by a really amazing woman, Zipporah Berman. And this, we've been engaged for several years. And it's really something that I think is critical mechanism parallel to the Paris Climate Accord, which is very important. And it created a certain context of agreements between countries, but doesn't address the supply end of the crisis of extraction of fossil fuels. And what's beautiful about the Fossil Fuel Treaty is it's a mechanism for governments all over the world to talk explicitly about coal, oil, and gas, which is what's causing the climate crisis, and get on with that as the main discussion. And it's really this campaign has initiative has gained so much momentum. And when we were in Dubai at the end of last year for COP28, there were different countries that signed on to endorse and continue endorsements from countries all over the world. And particularly, I was excited because the country of Colombia signed on to endorse the treaty, and that is a fossil fuel producing country. So that gave me a lot of hope that even a country that has a lot of fossil fuel financing was willing to look at moving off of fossil fuels, which is what we need to do. And so, those are just some of the things that come to mind that bring me a lot of hope.
I love all those. I love all those things. I actually had an episode about the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty and Rights of Nature. So love that. We love learning more about them, though. Each different one, each different time I hear about it, I hear something different. So thank you for bringing those up. And lastly, I just want to know, where can people buy your book?
Thank you for asking. Anywhere, really, where books are sold, anywhere. It's online at all the online outlets. If your bookstore doesn't have it, you can ask them to order it. But it's available everywhere right now. And thank you for mentioning it. I wrote the book to be for all of us, to be a movement book. You know, it's really a map and a guide, and all the things we've talked about are mentioned in the book. And yeah, thank you for letting me share about that. And people can also learn more about the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network by going to WeCan, WECAN, and then the word international spelled out .org. So WeCanInternational.org to learn about our organization. And then, as they say, I never thought these words would come out, wherever books are sold. We hear that all the time. So I can now say, you can get my book, The Story Is in Our Bones, wherever books are sold.
Love that. Yeah, you have to do some advertising.
Yes. Yes. That's my commercial.
Yeah, for anyone interested as well, I'll have different resources linked in the description, so it's easy for you just to go find and click. So is there anything else that you want to bring up before we wrap up?
It's just been such a delight to meet you and have this very wonderful, delicious conversation. And thank you for all that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and for sharing all of your wisdom with us.
And that wraps up this episode of The Hopeful Environmentalist. If you want to enjoy any of the resources that we talked about or discussed in this episode, feel free to head to the description of the bio. I also will have available different ways and different places that you can purchase Osprey's book. So if you're interested in that, I totally recommend it. Again, all in the description of the episode. So as always, thank you so much for listening to The Hopeful Environmentalist. And remember to stay hopeful and create positive change.